So I'd like to invite you back to the present, to our present time. Once I was big enough to get around by myself, I liked to wander down alleyways, into the thickets and the ditches, following stream beds through culverts, back out into the woods again. Almost anywhere a child could fit, which was a lot of places. And as a general rule, things like fences were ignored unless they were accompanied by large dogs or threatening signs or sound of electricity. These are also places where the casually discarded ends up. So mostly bottles and cans, cast off pieces of clothing and the like, bits of trash. Sometimes the rusted out hulks of abandoned cars or old appliances, their boxy shapes, a ghostly white presence in the shadows. And sometimes people, although not so much then. Small town dumps were particularly interesting places to wander, cornucopias of things no longer wanted, some still useful or pregnant with stories. Why would anybody throw away that perfectly good chair? Or the little red fire truck worn from the hands of a child playing? In all these places, these ditches and these hedgerows and these dumps are usually overgrown with what we call weeds. Now, weeds are plants that some people view as undesirable in a particular place. A plant that is a weed in one context is not a weed growing in a situation where it's wanted. One person's weed can be another's medicine, another's evening meal. And their names are a little unfamiliar these days, but they were once common knowledge. Amaranth, broadleaf plantain, burdock, lamb's quarters, creeping charlie, dandelion, goldenrod, milk thistle, sorrel and St. John's wort, sumac, wood sorrel, yellow nutsedge, to call in just a few of these useful plants. Now, many weeds do well in disturbed environments where soil or natural vegetative cover has been damaged. And these disturbances give the weeds advantages over other desirable crops, pastures, or ornamental plants. The term weed is also applied to any plant that grows or reproduces aggressively or is invasive outside its native habitat. More broadly, weed can also occasionally be applied derogatorily to species outside the plant kingdom, species that can survive in diverse environments and reproduce quickly. Such species often do well in human environments, human-dominated environments, that other species aren't able to adapt to, like the common pigeon and the brown rat and the raccoon. Other weedy species have been able to expand their range without actually living in human environments, as human activity has damaged the ecosystems of other species. The coyote, the white-tailed deer, the brown-headed cowbird, the crows and the ravens. Like other weedy species, humans reproduce quickly, disperse widely, live in a variety of habitats, establish populations in strange places, succeed in disturbed ecosystems, and resist eradication once established. It's illuminating to think of ourselves as weeds, rather than as the most desirable crop of some creator's cultivation. And that shift still allows us some small measure of pride, because as a species, we are the most successful of weeds. Or so it would seem from our admittedly biased perspective. You can tell a lot about a culture by who it considers to be weeds. People undesirable in a particular place, which could be a physical place or a social location. Welcome in the fields, but not the pews or the parlor. Welcome in the kitchen, but not the boardroom. And as Unitarian Universalists, we strive to be aware of this, and many sermons have been preached on this subject, but today I'm interested in rambling elsewhere. The small town dumps that I spoke of earlier are largely gone now, and they've been replaced with vast landfills swarming with giant machines, attended only by birds and a few humans. No child could ever wander there, sifting through the detritus of other lives. I count that as a loss. You can tell a lot about a culture by what it throws away, by what it tries to bury in the landfills of reality and of memory. For us, we strive to bury the past in a myriad of ways. Consider a landfill. A broad, deep hole is excavated, and it's lined with clay and some kind of thick plastic liner. It's filled with alternating layers of garbage and dirt, ultimately capped with a final layer of dirt. They stick pipes down in it to release the gases, and then they plant it with grass and trees, and then it's usually just left alone, although a few of them have been turned into parks. But much of its content doesn't decay. Or if it does, it's encapsulated. It's isolated from the cycle of life, of death and rebirth. It's unable to fertilize what comes next. Now, admittedly, much of it is toxic and dangerous, and it does need to be isolated. But that begs other questions like, why is that in our lives in the first place? And isn't there a better way than burying it and forgetting about it, hoping for the best? Consider a modern cemetery. A body is encapsulated in fiberglass or metal, isolated from the cycle of death and rebirth, unable to fertilize what comes next. It's buried within others in a place covered with green grass and trees. It's a solemn place, to be sure, but one that seems to be rarely visited, at least in white Western culture. It seems like it's a place where the dead go to die. Consider the dead. Not just our dead, but the dead of all species, all the plants and animals, the weeds, the dead of all the life that has gone before, the extinct species, the dead that feed the presents with the atoms of their bodies, bodies that came from the stars, the dead that feed the present with the memories of their acts. And these are all our ancestors. Those who came before, without whom we would not be here. Their flesh and bone transformed into our bones and our flesh. And as far as I can tell, all of our ancestors, no matter our lineage, venerated the dead. And we have encapsulated them, isolated them from the cycle of birth and death, unable to fertilize what comes next. The Pueblo peoples of the Southwest, here where we live, know that when the dead are venerated, they change into the clouds and the rain that nourish the earth. And when the dead are forgotten, the rains cease. Now, to take that literally is to do both us and them a disservice. Not all rains are visible. Not all droughts are physical. For them, and for the ancient Chinese poets, and so many other cultures, consciousness and memory reside in the landscape, in the sky, in the sun and the moon and the stars. The ancestors reside in the landscape, and the landscape itself is ripe with memory, conscious of the past, beckoning us into the future. The Senegalese poet Birago Diop wrote these words: "Hearing things more than beings, listening to the voice of fire, the voice of water, hearing in wind the weeping bushes, sighs of our forebears. The dead are never gone. They are in the shadows. The dead are not in the earth. They're in the rustling tree, the groaning wood, the water that runs, water that sleeps. They're in the hut, in the crowd. The dead are not dead. The dead are never gone. They're in the breast of a woman. They're in the crying child. In the flaming firebrand, the dead are not in the earth. They're in the dying fire, the weeping grasses, whimpering rocks. They're in the forest. They're in the house. The dead are not dead." No matter where we walk on this planet, the ground beneath us is layered with bones and pottery and bricks and old metal. It's layered with the atoms of all those beings who came before us, layered with roots that reach deep into the past. And we are part of that landscape. And there's little that we have thought or experienced that our ancestors did not conceive of, that they did not go through, and in many cases think far more deeply about than we do. They were survivors. They endured ice ages. They survived fire and flood, long years of wars, economic depressions, the rise and fall of empires, comets, plagues, and famines. They built cities and civilizations. I'd like to quote something for you. Let the reader follow in his mind how, as discipline broke down bit by bit, morality at first foundered. How it next subsided into ever greater collapse and then began to topple headlong into ruin. Until the advent of our own age in which we can endure neither our vices nor the remedies needed to cure them. Recent wealth has brought greed in its train. Manifold amusements have led to people's obsession with ruining themselves and with consuming all else through excess and self-indulgence. One might think those words were written yesterday, but they were written just over 2,000 years ago by the Roman historian Titus Livius, known to us as Livy, who I quoted at the beginning. And he wrote those words shortly after Augustus, to the acclaim of the Senate and the people of Rome, effectively ended the Roman Republic by becoming dictator in all but name. Now, Livy believed that Augustus would restore Rome to the moral virtues of its humble beginnings. And we know that never happened. And we also know that whatever truth there may be to the idea of a glorious past for any nation, the very idea is also suspect. Because Rome continued its decline, as all empires have done. Now, it's very tempting to think that empires decline and fall because of moral decay. Livy thought so. Gibbon did as well. It's particularly tempting for people of faith because morality is our stock and trade. But empires fall for lots of reasons. But for me, the point is that Livy sounds like a contemporary. One could easily imagine him spouting his opinions on cable TV talk shows. Our ancestors wrestled with the same issues we do. They too sought justice and equality and a say in how they were governed. Here's Livy again. So difficult it is to observe moderation in the defense of liberty, while each man under the presence of equality raises himself only by keeping others down. And by their very precautions against fear, men make themselves feared. And in repelling injury from ourselves, we inflict it on others as though there were no alternative between doing wrong and suffering it. And this from Aristotle. In all sciences and arts, the end is a good. And the greatest good, and in the highest degree, a good in the most authoritative of all. This is the political science of which the good is justice. In other words, the common interest. Now, I don't seek to analyze their words or debate what I consider to be their eternal truth. And I'm not here to point out how far or little we have come in 2,000 years. But instead, I ask you to think of these words as something remembered, as an old memory surfacing, a link in an ancestral chain of thought and being that goes back millennia. One of the challenges in the present is our relationship with the dead and with death. Our news is filled with research whose end is immortality, either in the physical world by some medical magic, or perhaps we're transplanted into a new body, a clone, or into a robot, or perhaps we're uploaded into some cloud to live forever as bits of data. Our medical establishment seeks to delay death at all costs. And the aged and dying are segregated so we no longer have to face our own mortality. We think death is an end, and so we fear death. We no longer seek an honorable death and a place with the ancestors, becoming part of a continuity that stretches back into deep time. And those who came before us knew better. As Livy and Aristotle show us, our ancestors were pretty sophisticated, no matter which lineage we come from. One of the underlying conceits of our time is that the people of the past were primitive and unsophisticated and driven by foolish beliefs and ignorance. And I think we're encouraged to believe this because it cuts us off from our ancestors. It denies their wisdom and their strength. It renders us powerless in the face of great change, in living in a time of increasing challenge and uncertainty. But the truth is, We're weeds. We're strong and adaptable. Generations and generations live inside of us. We contain multitudes, and in their memories are memories of meeting or perhaps failing to meet the challenges of the past. And part of our task is to discover how all these ancestors, human and other than human, continue to inform our lives. So, like those who came before, let us remember our sacred ancestors. Let us delve deep into their memories